you could spare it. You know you have it under the bed. Just go get it, cash it in, and call KPFK, 818-985-5735. We're talking with Amy Goodman live in New York at the airport, a national treasure, as one of your guests with Brunch and a Broadcast said. He's like, oh, I'm here with the national treasure right here. And I think he was talking about Zazu. I'm not...
Zazu or his avocado toast.
That's right. So once again, folks, we're going to let you know we got those Santana tickets for a $150 donation. Be right there. Intimate concert with Carlos Santana. That's two tickets, and that'll be in Vegas. Give you an excuse to head down there to Vegas, and that's over there at the House of Blues. And then we do have tickets for Wayne Brady, comedian, improvisation and comedy is what he's all about, and he's got two shows, 7 and 9:30 at the Blue Note in L.A., and this is August 15th and 16th at the Blue Note on Sunset Boulevard. That's for an $80 donation. But, folks, if we can get, like I say, how about 50 of you pledging $25 all over these freeways when we talk about 210, Highway 60, Highway 101, Highway 10, wherever you're at, 210, 605, and you could be in Pasadena, you could be in Chino Hills, you could be in Pomona, Corona. Give us a call at 818-985-5735. If we could get like $20,000, or how about $10,000? Yeah, we could do it. We have listeners that are loyal and trust KPFK with their news, and we are here for you. 818-985-5735, and we're about to finish here. We'd like to thank also folks like Maggie LaPique, who you know, put in everything, and also Ozzy and D'Angelo, Mark Maxwell, Arnella Barbara,
thank you,
Donna
Mr.
Walker,
G.
Terry Guy, Rita, and all the rest of the folks here at KPFK that have been working day and night to take your pledges and create programming here.
And every time, if I may say something, and every time I walk through these doors, every time I sit behind this microphone, every sponsorship I write, every email I send, every phone call I make, every hour I spend here, I remember why we do it. Not just me, all of us. We do it for you. KPFK isn't just a building or a frequency on the radio. KPFK is all of us, right, Mr. G?
Oh,
let's
yeah.
do it one more time. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, option two, Mr. G.
And, you know, Arnella, I got to give you a hug for all that, you know what I mean?
Oh.
You deserve a hug. But most of all is we got to thank our listeners,
yes.
our donors out there,
absolutely.
The people that keep us on the air. And, of course, you know, we couldn't do it without Tom Hartman and Amy Goodman with Democracy Now! So thank you, Amy.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks. Keep those phone calls coming in. That's the best applause we can hear, is keeping people powered. KPFK, Pacifica Radio, corporate free, 818-985-5735. Or go to kpfk.org. The media is under assault. The president calls the media the enemy of the people. This is the time to support your station, because independent media is essential to the functioning of a democratic society. 818-985-5735. Do what you can. Your weekend will be better because you supported KPFK.
Yeah,
or
absolutely.
Just go to kpfk.org and make that pledge. Thank you, thank you, thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Amy, and we can't wait to hear Democracy Now! On Monday morning at 7 and then again at 4. And we got to give it up for our 5 o'clock audience, 6 o'clock audience, who come through all the time, the evening commute. We love you. We appreciate you. And I should say that, yes, the fun drive ends now, but if there's something that you heard, like, let's say maybe a book, the Dave Zirin book.
Great book.
That'll be available.
About Howard Zinn.
That's correct. And that'll be available for all of next week. We won't be pitching it and talking about it, but you can just call in and get it. And so some of these items that we are offering will be around for next week, but you got to call in and let us know, because we will not be offering these, any of these, dinner, brunch and a broadcast. You can get that next week. Just call in, but we just want you to know that we will have the premiums or the offers, the thank you gifts, available after this fun drive for a week. But it's over right now, so hey, pledge what you can. 818-985-5735, and thank you so much, Amy Goodman.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, everyone. Keep the phone calls coming in. Thank you.
Ring. There's a phone right now.
Yes, it's ringing. Without you, there is no KPFK, and with you, we keep going together. 818-985-5735.
And now Option time for two. The news.
It's Friday, August 7th. I'm Scott Baba. An appeals court pumps the brakes on President Donald Trump's White House ballroom.
It's not surprising that courts are weighing in and saying, no, you have to follow the rules. And let's see what happens as this gets to higher courts as well. But look, if the president's going to do stuff, he just follow the rules and do it, instead of just deciding one day he's going to take a jackhammer and start popping the road open wherever he wants to. It's like,
the federal government moves to undermine California's Coastal Commission.
California recently went through its regular review for the Coastal Management Program and got high marks from
Occupied West Bank, the first such indictment since October of 2023, according to the rights group B'Tselem. Enon Levy faces charges of reckless manslaughter in the death of activist Ada Hotelin last July, along with armed trespassing and property damage. Video from the day shows Levy firing shots toward Hotelin's village. Prosecutors say the first shot struck Hotelin, who later died at the hospital. Hotelin was a prominent opponent of settler violence and appeared in the Oscar-winning film No Other Land. Seth Morrison is with Jewish Voice for Peace and Face to Face, an organization that provides Jewish reparations for Palestinians. Morrison, who was friends with Hotelin, noted that it took over a year for Levy to be charged.
After Ada was murdered, Levy was let go immediately, and then they charged him with, I forget exactly what, and he was put on house arrest for about a day or day and a half, and then the charges were dropped and he was released. And, you know, this is typical of Israel in that settler terrorists are almost never held responsible for their actions, and only the most egregious actions and the actions that are most publicized around the world get any legal attention from Israeli prosecutors. You know, we know that Levy and the other settlers are protected by the Israeli army. And, you know, the minute they go into a village and start doing terrible things, they call the army because they know that the army is not going to get in their way.
Morrison said he believed Levy was only charged because of international pressure and politics.
Israel is seeing its public opinion in the U.S. tanking. It's lower than it's ever been before. The Israeli government is spending hundreds of millions of dollars on propaganda and trying to influence U.S. public opinion. So it's very possible that somebody said, you know, this one is so egregious, we've got to deal with it. And, you know, Levy happens to be the one who's getting a lot of publicity lately, so he's the one they're putting on trial.
Levy has said he'll fight the charges, calling the case an attack on self-defense. His lawyers call the prosecution a mistake. Hotelin's family called the indictment a big step, though they say it won't bring him back. Morrison said while he was pleased with the charges, he would wait for a conviction before celebrating.
We also know that while 99% of Palestinians tried in Israeli courts are found guilty, 98% of settler terrorists tried in Israel courts are released. So, you know, it's a good step. We hope that they move towards a conviction.
But Salem says Israeli settlers and soldiers have killed more than 1,100 Palestinians in the West Bank since October of 2023, calling this case a rare exception to near total impunity. The Senate has approved a punishing Russian sanctions bill that was a top priority for the late Senator Lindsey Graham. Passage of the package today signaled renewed bipartisan support for Ukraine as the war drags on. The legislation would penalize countries that continue to buy Russian oil, gas, and other exports. It comes after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited the capital late last month and watched from the gallery as the Senate took the first procedural votes on the legislation. The legislation allows the president to impose tariffs on the world's top five purchasers of Russian oil or natural gas, including China and India. The package next goes to the House, but some Democrats have concerns it gives Trump too much tariff authority. A federal appeals court has blocked President Trump from building a new White House ballroom without congressional approval. A split three-judge panel on the D.C. Circuit ruled 2-1 that Trump can't move forward with the 90,000-square-foot ballroom planned on the site of the demolished East Wing, using up to $400 million in private donations. The majority of the court wrote that a project that size is for Congress to decide, not the executive branch acting alone. The ruling upholds a lower court judge's finding that Trump overstepped by demolishing the East Wing without congressional authorization. Judge Naomi Rao dissented, arguing the National Trust for Historic Preservation, which brought the suit, lacked standing and that the president likely has authority to build the ballroom. Democratic Senator Ben Ray Lujan of New Mexico said he agreed with the ruling to stop the ballroom, but questioned whether it would deter the president for long.
The president said that that folks were going to chip in to pay for it and it was not going to be at the cost of the American taxpayer. That's already proven to be untrue. So it's not surprising that courts are weighing in and saying, no, you have to follow the rules. And let's see what happens as this gets to higher courts as well. But look, if the president's going to do stuff, he just follow the rules and do it instead of just deciding one day he's going to take a jackhammer and start popping the road open wherever he wants to. And say, you know, there's a way to do things and a way not to. And he's going to do things the way he always does, which is his own way, and he's not going to follow any rules around it.
Republican Senator John Hoeven of North Dakota argued that regardless of how it was getting done, Trump's efforts would end up being a long-term benefit to the United States.
Number one, the president's raised a lot of private money to fund it, and that's going to be something that future administrations can use, whether they're Republican or Democrat. That's a benefit. And so I think one way or another, yeah, we'll work through it and get it done, but that's something that's going to be beneficial to future administrations for years to come, Republican and Democrat.
But Democratic Senator Peter Welch of Vermont said that Trump's projects were an inappropriate use of public resources, and stated unequivocally that there was no way the president would be able to get congressional Democratic support.
We will never give the presidential approval for the Arc de Triomphe or the East Wing Ballroom. I mean, these are vanity projects. And some reports indicate that the president is spending literally 70% of his time. The president's a busy person, and there's a lot of things he's got to pay attention to, including the war in Iran. So, no.
The court paused its own ruling for 14 days to let the administration appeal to the Supreme Court. Trump said he'll do just that. The president also blasted the decision as unjust, calling the ballroom a, quote, desperately needed military center, and saying the ruling endangers White House workers. The National Trust called the decision a win for the public's right to weigh in on historic sites. Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook is once again facing off against President Donald Trump 2 months after a high court ruling allowed her to keep her job while she fights the president's efforts to terminate her. A letter this week from the White House to Cook said President Trump was, quote, considering firing Cook, but wanted to give her an opportunity to challenge the effort. Ed Donahue reports.
The Trump administration is moving ahead again to try to fire Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook. Last year, President Trump accused Cook of mortgage fraud.
But no, she seems to have had an infraction, and she can't have an infraction, especially that infraction, because she's in charge of, if you think about it, mortgages, and we need people that are 100% above board.
Cook says the allegations are manufactured because she sets interest rates based only on what would best serve the American people. 2 months ago, the Supreme Court allowed Cook to retain her job. But Chief Justice John Roberts wrote in a footnote in his opinion, nothing forbids the president from trying to fire Cook again, as long as she is given proper notice and a chance to contest it. The president indicated after the opinion he would do just that. The new letter to Cook rehashes the old allegations. Ed Donahue, Washington.
The White House is drafting an executive order linking vaccines to autism, according to reports from the Washington Post and Bloomberg, citing unnamed sources. Bloomberg reports the order could come as soon as next week. The Post says drafting so far focuses on the childhood vaccine schedule, autism research, and parental choice. Dozens of large studies have found no link between vaccines and autism. The original claim came from a fraudulent retracted study whose author lost his medical license. Reports say the push is coming directly from President Trump, who reportedly wants to be remembered as the president who cured autism. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a longtime vaccine skeptic, has reportedly been pressed by Trump to do more on the issue, even as Kennedy has otherwise pulled back from discussing vaccines publicly, given the political risk. A White House spokesperson said the administration will rely on, quote, gold standard science for the vaccine schedule. Medical groups and autism advocates have rejected the vaccine autism claim as a waste of resources. Republican Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana said he'll vote for Todd Blanche as Attorney General, likely paving the way for Blanche to be confirmed to lead President Donald Trump's Justice Department. Cassidy announced his support today on the Senate floor, saying Blanche isn't perfect, but no one is. Blanche's confirmation had been threatened by opposition from two other Republican senators, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine. Donna Warder reports.
Senate approval of Todd Blanche as U.S. Attorney General had been thrown into doubt with opposition from Republican Senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine. But Republican Bill Cassidy of Louisiana says he will vote yes. Cassidy says Blanche did show poor judgment in approving the $1.8 billion fund to compensate people who feel they were mistreated by the criminal justice system, but says Blanche has made efforts to kill it. The agreement also provided Trump and family members with immunity from tax audits.
This is not a referendum on President Trump. It is a decision regarding Mr. Blanche in very specific circumstances. All considered, I will vote for Mr. Blanche. I'll be criticized for this vote. What's new?
Donna Warder, Washington.
The California Department of Pesticide Regulation today held the first meeting of its Scientific Prioritization and Review Committee, or SPARC, at the California EPA headquarters in Sacramento. The committee is meant to help the Department of Pesticide Regulation take action on pesticides. Max Pringle reports.
The committee advises the state DPR on the latest science connected to pesticides and their impact on the environment and human health, and of the viability of safe alternatives to pest management. J.T. Turling is a SPARC Deputy Director of Registration and Evaluation.
Critical to this mission is to continuously evaluate currently registered pesticides in the face of evolving science and prioritize our work to mitigate any risks that are identified.
The committee is made up of 12 appointed scientific practitioner experts. One of SPARC's priorities is supporting the broader transition to safer, more sustainable pest management practices statewide. Again, J.T. Turling.
One of the changes that we want to make sure we're incorporating as a part of our work is that at the time that we identify risks, we're talking about alternatives at that time. We know that there are critical tools for pest management needs throughout California, and we want to make sure to have a discussion about what feasible alternatives are at the time we identify risks.
SPARC says part of its mission is to act as an open public forum for discussing data-driven priorities to protect human health and the environment. Susan Kegley is principal scientist and co-founder of the Pesticide Research Institute, She says many chemical pesticides have been on the danger watch list and have been studied and found to be harmful, but little action has been made to stop using them.
What disturbs me a little bit is that many of the chemicals that are currently being evaluated have been on these lists for a long, long time. I am working with the Pollinator Stewardship Council with regard to the beepocalypse, if you will, of 2025 and continuing somewhat lesser extent this year.
Ann Catton is with the California Rural Legal Foundation. She says regulators already have a fairly extensive list of toxic substances. She said she's concerned that SPARC will just repeat work that's already been done.
It's very important that we not reinvent the wheel. We already have a very good list from CalEnviroScreen of high-priority pesticides. The top six are fumigants, and that's no coincidence because they are all highly volatile, used at very high concentrations, and are very highly chronically and acutely toxic, depending on the chemical.
The DPR created SPARC in April. To submit public comments, SPARC advises that the public use their online portal, send a written comment, or speak during a scheduled public hearing. The next public meeting of SPARC is scheduled for December 4th. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
The Council on American Islamic Relations California condemned death threats tweeted by anti-Muslim extremist and former FBI agent John Guandolo on X against Muslim American civil rights activist and CARE CEO Hussam Ailush. Ailush has been part of a civil rights engagement campaign encouraging Muslim Americans to get out and vote. KPFA's Sharon Sabota spoke with Hussam Ailush and filed this report.
When I chose to quit my aerospace job, maybe almost 28 years ago, and sign up for CARE to do civil rights and human rights work, I knew it's not always going to be pleasant.
That's Muslim American civil rights activist Hussam Ailush, who's also the chief executive officer of CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, California. Ailush has been spending time visiting mosques, registering people to vote, and encouraging them to learn the issues so they're prepared to participate in the primary elections. Well, Ailush has been out encouraging peaceful participation. A man who identifies as a former FBI agent, John Guandolo, posted a message on X. Ailush read a portion of it.
In Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and other such countries, American military men would end disturbed. In America, he's on CNN. So basically, he's dwelling that I haven't received a bullet in my head yet. And then he signals that, you know, this is how patriotic American view such what he describes as terrorist.
Ailush says that he believes Donald Trump has normalized Islamophobia and hateful rhetoric, which has emboldened people like the man who implied that he should lose his life.
The president tweets a picture of schoolgirls, students in Minnesota, you know, and gives the impression that somehow Somali, you know, immigrant looking or hijab wearing students, you know, girls who go to school, public schools, somehow they're outsiders. It is not the impact that, you know, yeah, every student is going to be impacted, but what it does, it creates a climate of otherization. It creates a climate where people in America are told there are two classes in America. You know, everybody is equal, but some are more equal than others.
Ailush noted commonalities between the struggle for people to share their voices and their opposition to Israel's U.S.-funded war on Gaza with other pivotal moments in history.
People who engage in standing up against genocide, funded by our tax money, to make them feel guilty. You know, it just tells you how twisted things are today. Instead of pointing the finger at those who are engaging in funding, supporting, and excusing genocide, we're actually flipping it around, and now we're shaming those who are risking their comfort, risking their jobs, risking their safety to speak up against the genocide. So it tells you this is a really strange times, but not unusual in our history. People who stood up against slavery, people who stood up against the you know, all sorts of injustices, you know, from apartheid in South Africa to Vietnam War to segregation, never had it easy. It was never easy because people who protect the status quo, that is how they defend their status quo, by flipping it against you. You're the threat now if you dare to challenge that unjust status quo.
Ailush credits Jewish Americans for being among the most vocal people when challenging the ongoing genocide against Palestinians.
Anti-Semitism is weaponized in an attempt to silence those who criticize the state of Israel. In my opinion, one of the worst forms of anti-Semitism is those who try to blame or associate Judaism and the Jewish people with the crimes and the human rights abuses committed by the state of Israel. I would say it's the same form of bigotry when people try to blame or associate Islam or Muslims with the crimes committed by Muslim extremists such as ISIS or Al-Qaeda.
Ailush is encouraging all Americans to push politicians to do the right thing and points to New York as an example.
If the recent results of elections in the largest American city and the most Jewish city in America and one of the most Jewish cities in the country, in the world, talking about New York, if we can see someone like Zohran Mamdani getting elected, on a platform that is very domestic, very local for New York, and dealing with poverty and inequity and all that, but also very vocal in his position in support of human rights for the Palestinians. And for him to be elected and continuously to be actually one of the most recent polls show that actually Mamdani is more popular among Jews in America than Netanyahu is. It tells you, it gives the deserved credit to the Jewish community, something that the supporters of Israel refuse to do.
For Pacifica, KPFA, I'm Sharon Sabota.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement says it plans to have body cameras on all field officers by the end of September, but its policy gives the agency wide discretion over which footage becomes public. Under the new rules, ICE will only promptly release video of shootings or other serious incidents if officials determine the move is, quote, in the best interests of the agency. But if the ICE director finds that specific and compelling circumstances justify withholding the video, they have the authority to block or indefinitely delay the release, with no requirements to explain why. Critics say the language effectively lets ICE control its own narrative. Brandon University professor Christopher Schneider, who studies police body cameras, said the agency is, quote, saying the quiet part out loud about using footage as an image tool. Project on Government Oversight senior legal analyst Catherine Hawkins said without a clear path for the public to see the footage, the policy makes cameras, quote, virtually useless. The rollout falls recent fatal shootings by ICE officers in Maine and Houston, neither captured on camera since the officers involved didn't have them yet. Those incidents angered members of Congress who'd given ICE $20 million specifically to buy cameras months earlier. ICE spent nearly $31 million last month on camera equipment from Axon, the maker of tasers. More than half of field officers already have cameras, with the rest getting them by September's end, though that timeline has already slipped from earlier estimates. Even when footage is released, officers' faces, names, and badge numbers will be blacked out to protect their privacy. 3-2-1. The agency's policies. 3-2-1. The agency has said that even when footage is released, officers' faces, names, and badge numbers could be blacked out to protect their privacy. White House Border Czar Tom Homan defended the cameras, saying they're more likely to clear officers than show wrongdoing. ICE first tested body cameras back in 2021, but full deployment stalled for years. Meanwhile, a bill moving through Congress would empower ICE with the authority to coordinate federal efforts against large-scale shoplifting. Authored by Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, the Combating Organized Retail Crime Act, or CORCA, directs ICE to set up a, quote, organized retail and supply chain crime coordination center, pulling together agents and analysts from the FBI, DEA, Customs and Border Protection, Secret Service, and other agencies under one roof. The center would be led by a director hand-picked by ICE's chief and staffed in part by ICE agents. It's unclear whether ICE agents would have authority to confront suspects directly. The center could also share information deemed legally confidential, including people's financial and business records, with the director's sign-off. The bill has bipartisan support, including from 13 Senate Democrats, including co-sponsor Democratic Minority Whip Dick Durbin of Illinois. The House passed the bill in May, and Senators Grassley and Durbin say they want to attach it to next year's defense funding bill. Civil liberties groups warn it would let retailers share surveillance data, including security footage and license plate readers, with DHS and local police. The ACLU's Nina Patel said ICE can't be trusted with the added power given the agency's track record. Critics also questioned the underlying premise. The National Retail Federation retracted a widely cited claim that organized theft caused half of 2021's retail losses. The real figure was closer to 5%. The Senate confirmed Cameron Hamilton as head of the embattled Federal Emergency Management Agency today. Hamilton was among 74 nominations approved by the Senate Friday. The former Navy SEAL is returning to the agency he briefly led last year. FEMA's future has been uncertain since President Donald Trump threatened to eliminate the agency. Hamilton's nomination suggests Trump may be moving on from that idea, but his administration is promising major changes in federal disaster response. Democrats accused the Republican president of politicizing disaster aid. The Senate also approved David Cummins to lead the Transportation Security Administration and Daniel Perez for the ambassador to Brazil.
Music of the World with Joanna Manqueros
and Taufik Halabi airs Saturday mornings, 9 to 11 a.m.
Once a month, we...
Not only are KPFK listeners smart, interesting, and forward-thinking, you're also very generous and deeply appreciated. Thank you so much for pledging your support to KPFK during our fund drive.
Austin, you're listening to Radical Free Speech Radio, KPFK, in Los Angeles.
Communities along California's coast are expressing alarm over the Trump administration's unprecedented review of the state's coastal management program. State officials say the move is aimed at ramping up offshore drilling, downgrading environmental protection, and exerting more federal control over the state's 1,100-mile coastline. The Newsom administration announced it is filing formal comments opposing the review. The U.S. Department of Commerce has announced official hearings to be held to evaluate the state's coastal management program. KPFA's Vic Bedoyan has more.
For nearly half a century, the California Coastal Commission has helped protect the environment, manage development, and enhance public access. Now the Trump administration is threatening to override the state's management of its coastal resources. California's Natural Resources Agency is at the forefront of the conflict. Leader Wade Crowfoot said the administration's goal is extracting more resources with less oversight.
First and foremost, there's an aggressive drive to, for the first time in over 40 years, expand offshore oil drilling, which is a major concern to leaders from both political parties in California across our coastal communities. There has been a pretty extraordinary and we believe illegal federal action to restart a pipeline called the Sable Pipeline that hasn't undergone or completed safety checks that caused our most recent oil spill off California's coast in 2015, the Refugio oil spill.
Crowfoot explained the federal government has invoked extraordinary national defense powers to restart the pipeline. He says the federal government is moving toward an aggressive way to introduce industrial deep sea mining off the coast while trying to cancel planned clean energy and offshore wind projects. He added that the state's coastal management program was reviewed in 2024 and passed with flying colors.
California recently went through its regular review for the coastal management program and got high marks from the federal government. But under this administration, they've now initiated a new review only a year and a half after those recent findings. And that has us very concerned about the potential removal of our coastal management program, which again would erase a lot of public process about being able to figure into federal decisions.
The Coastal Zone Management Act is a seminal law passed in the early 1970s, along with the Clean Water and Clean Air Acts. It requires federal agencies and states to coordinate and work together in managing the nation's coastlines. Derek Brockbank is CEO of the Coastal States Organization. They work as a collective voice for coastal states and islands. He maintains the federal government is not allowed to do something on a coastline that is inconsistent with a state's policies for the coast.
Having that law on the books that says a state is allowed to object is what allows the federal government and the state government to work together. And it's what brings the federal government to the table with the state government, which in turn allows local communities to participate in that federal decision-making process.
California's Coastal Commission is one of the most successful and high-profile agencies, working with many federal administrations over time to control development, conserve nature, and foster outdoor recreation. But that could change. Kate Hulkebridge heads the commission and emphasizes how that federal-state partnership has improved coastal protection in the past.
Again, 48-year history, the Coastal Commission has reviewed more than 3,700 federal actions. And in 96% of those cases, we have either negotiated improvements or approved a project as submitted, whether it was from the federal government itself or an entity doing a federal-related project.
The threat of ramped-up offshore oil production looms over the federal move to control California's coast, according to state officials. That is a major concern for Ray Jackson. He's a Hermosa Beach City Council member and on the Coastal Commission. He knows firsthand the widespread damage that an oil spill can cause.
In 21, Huntington Beach saw an oil spill that forced beach closures, canceled major events, emptied hotels, and hurt restaurants, surf shops, fishermen, and the countless other local businesses. And if there's an oil spill or when there's another oil spill anywhere along our coastline, the damage extends far beyond the economic impacts. It threatens marine ecosystems, closes beaches, deprives veterans, nonprofits, service swimmers, and families of the healing, the recreation, and ocean therapy that our coastline provides.
There is also concern about California's economy. It's the world's fourth largest. The Pacific Coast's natural resources and businesses are an important part of that economy. Industries such as tourism, recreation, marine transportation, commercial fishing, and shipbuilding. Dee Dee Myers is director of the Governor's Office of Business and Economic Development.
California's 19 coastal counties generate the lion's share of our economic output, more than 70%. And as you also noted, more than two-thirds of the state's population live in the coastal areas. And so, you know, if you think about the size of California's economy, $4.25 trillion, the fourth largest economy in the world, and more than 70% of that comes from our coastal region. So that just gives you kind of an idea of how important it is.
John Finger has made a living on the coast for decades, running the Hog Island Oyster Farm and restaurants. He praised the state's Coastal Commission for protecting natural resources and creating a stable business environment. He said having coordination on regulations between the state and the feds is extremely important for his business.
To think about that, the feds going this way and the state going that way could really impact our abilities actually to grow more of this. You know, we actually think there's opportunity to do more sustainable aquaculture in the state with shellfish and seaweed. A lot of that would be not necessarily within bays, but out on the coast. And if you don't have stability in permitting and the regulatory outlook, I mean, that goes nowhere. People are not going to invest. We're not going to be able to grow, you know, more great food.
A series of public hearings will be held by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to evaluate the state's coastal management program. That includes an in-person meeting in Santa Monica August 10th and virtual meetings on August 11th and 12th. More information is posted on the Coastal Commission website. Vic Bedoyan reporting for Pacifica Evening News and KFCF Radio.
The Santa Clara County Superior Court heard arguments this week over whether a lawsuit challenging San Jose's use of automated license plate readers should move forward. The lawsuit names the city, its mayor, and police officials. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, the American Civil Liberties Union, the Council on American Islamic Relations, and the Institute for Justice say San Jose is putting immigrants, abortion seekers, and protesters at risk with what they call dystopian and un-American technology. Lauren Schmidt reports.
The Fourth Amendment is a cornerstone of the United States Constitution, protecting people from unreasonable searches and seizures. Legal scholars say this constitutional right is intended to serve as a buffer between the immense power of law enforcement and private citizens, guaranteeing people the right to be, quote, secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects, close quote. It also prohibits unreasonable searches conducted without a warrant. But the framers of the Constitution would likely be shocked by modern technology. From motor vehicles to the mass surveillance systems deployed across the country to track them. Automated license plate readers, or ALPRs, record where and when motorists travel. The technology, used primarily by law enforcement agencies, is now testing the limits of the Fourth Amendment. According to the Plate Privacy Project, a new initiative launched by the Institute for Justice, ALPR cameras now operate in more than 6,000 communities nationwide, scanning an average of 2,000 license plates every minute. In the Bay Area, reporting by the Oakland Side found that nearly 300 ALPR cameras across Oakland recorded more than 600 million license plate scans in 2025 alone. But reporter Eli Wolf found that only a tiny fraction were connected to potential crimes, less than 1% generating a so-called hot list alert. While the technology is not new, concerns have intensified over the scale of surveillance, AI integration, and the potential misuse of the information it collects. From tracking pregnant people traveling across state lines for abortion care to assisting immigration enforcement operations. Communities across the country have begun pushing back, including here in California. Earlier this year, the Santa Cruz City Council voted to terminate its contract with Flock Safety, reportedly becoming the first city in the nation to do so. El Cerrito recently followed suit, with its city council voting to not renew its Flock contract and has begun removing the 40 cameras currently in place. While Flock has become a household name in the fight against mass surveillance, civil rights groups warned that all automated license plate reader systems pose serious privacy risks. In November, two nonprofit organizations sued the city of San Jose, its mayor, and police chief, challenging the city's warrantless use of automated license plate readers. The lawsuit alleges that the surveillance violates the California Constitution's protections against unreasonable searches and its guarantee of privacy. This week, the groups are in court asking a judge to declare the warrantless searches unconstitutional, a ruling that could set an important precedent across California and influence similar challenges nationwide. The Electronic Frontier Foundation and the ACLU of Northern California brought the case on behalf of two organizations, SIREN, which serves immigrant, indigenous, and refugee communities across the Bay Area and Central Valley, and the Council on American Islamic Relations. Zara Ballou is the executive director of CARES San Francisco Bay Office.
We are suing the city of San Jose based on unwarranted access to ALPR records by the San Jose Police Department.
The plaintiffs argue that the San Jose Police Department uses its camera network to indiscriminately collect millions of records each month about people's movements. That information, they say, is stored for up to a year. They argue that officers and other law enforcement officials across the state can search the database to reconstruct people's movements over time without first obtaining a warrant. The plaintiffs describe that practice as unchecked police power, saying it allows authorities to scrutinize San Jose residents and visitors as they lawfully travel to work, visit a doctor, or attend a protest.
There is little to no oversight of how the police department is accessing these records, thereby violating all of our privacy rights.
The case was filed in November 2025. The defendants include San Jose Police Chief Paul Joseph and its mayor, Matt Mahan. Despite their attorneys seeking to have the case dismissed, it proceeded to court this Thursday. As for why a Muslim civil rights organization has taken on the ALPR fight, CARE says its mission is to protect the rights of communities through advocacy and empowerment.
In San Jose in particular, we are concerned that there are automated license plate readers in a variety of locations, including sensitive locations outside of and nearby mosques where Muslims attend prayers. In an environment where racial and religious profiling continues to run rampant, it is problematic that law enforcement could access information about who attended mosques and when, with little to no oversight and without a warrant.
Bellew says the lawsuit is not about shielding illegal activity, but preventing government overreach and protecting innocent people.
It is to say what could be done with private information about our lives, our First Amendment practices, and the like. It's simply not the government's business when I go to a mosque or who I go to a mosque with or even which mosque I go to.
The complaint points to records released in the San Jose ALPR audit documents, which showed that more than 361 million license plates were scanned in 2024, but less than 1% resulted in an enforcement match. The lawsuit argues that San Jose does not require police to have any suspicion of wrongdoing before searching drivers' historical movements through the city.
Our privacy rights are enshrined in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights in particular. They are fundamental to our identity and existence as Americans.
And while California has enacted privacy protections, including SB 34, which regulates how license plate data is collected, accessed, and shared, and AB 1242, which restricts California authorities from assisting out-of-state abortion investigations, civil rights advocates say significant gaps remain. And neither law broadly require police to obtain a warrant before searching an ALPR database. And the Electronic Frontier Foundation note that existing restrictions have not always been followed. In 2023, the Civil Liberty Group reported that 71 California law enforcement agencies had shared license plate data with their out-of-state counterparts.
So our main concern here was that law enforcement officers in anti-abortion jurisdictions can use ALPR location data that's collected in California to monitor abortion clinics and the vehicle scene around them, and thus be able to closely track the movements of abortion seekers and providers. And because we found such prominent sharing with out-of-state agencies, including states where abortion is criminalized, by way of example, it would be relatively easy for an investigator to query the address of an abortion clinic to reveal the vehicles that are parked at or near the clinic, including patients, providers, and others who visit the facility.
That was EFF attorney Jennifer Pinsoff, who says violations were documented across 22 counties. The largest numbers were in Orange, Los Angeles, and Contra Costa counties. California Attorney General Rob Bonta later issued guidance confirming that SB 34 prohibits California agencies from sharing ALPR data with federal or out-of-state agencies. But advocates say the violations demonstrate how easily sensitive location information can travel beyond the jurisdiction where it was collected, and how difficult it becomes to control it once it enters a nationwide surveillance network. Across the country, there have also been reports of officers using these databases to assist immigration enforcement agents and surveil protesters. Those concerns have only intensified under President Donald Trump. His National Security Presidential Memorandum 7 marked a major shift in U.S. counterterrorism policy, directing federal agencies to investigate and disrupt what the administration describes as organized political violence associated with the so-called radical left. Trump would also issue an executive order designating Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization, despite the FBI director in 2020 saying Antifa is an ideology, not an organization. And CalMatters reported that a federal contract involving an ICE detention facility in Southern California included language allowing the facility to hold not only immigrants, but people classified by the government as domestic terrorists, an expansion the reporter described as unprecedented. Civil advocates warned that in this political climate, mass surveillance systems could increasingly be used to identify and track protesters and political activists. Pinsoff is one of the attorneys representing CARE in the challenge against San Jose. But notably, this is not the only lawsuit the city faces over its license plate reader network. In spring, several San Jose residents filed a federal class action lawsuit challenging the city's use of its nearly 500 plate readers. That case is being litigated by the Institute for Justice as part of its Plate Privacy Project, which challenges warrantless mass surveillance. One of the plaintiffs, Tony Tan, shared this message in a video posted to the Institute for Justice's YouTube page.
I live in San Jose, California, and I am a software engineer specializing in privacy. As I've been driving around the city, I've noticed an increasing number of these camera-looking devices that have antennas and solar panels. As I learned more about these license plate readers, I realized that any police officer can search through these license plate reader records without having to show any reason to a judge or go through any other kind of process. As an engineer specializing in privacy, I understand that a key component to privacy is minimizing the data that is being collected. San Jose isn't minimizing. They're maximizing the data being collected.
Tan says he grew up in China, Japan, and the United States. He currently lives in downtown San Jose and works as a software engineer who specializes in consumer privacy. He has never been arrested or charged with a crime, but says he is politically active and attends protests across the Bay Area and volunteers as a legal observer, monitoring immigration enforcement activity and informing people of their rights.
I'm worried about the system being abused. I'm worried about police officers looking at this data just because they're curious. I'm worried about the federal government getting access to this data and using it against me and other politically active people. I'm also just worried about data breaches. There should be guardrails around how we use these systems. There should be limits on how much data is collected and for how long. And police should have to get a warrant before looking at the places that I've been to over the past month.
The lawsuit highlights that the placement of ALPR cameras are located near six immigration law firms. And an investigation by 404 Media found that police across the country conducted thousands of searches of Flock's nationwide database on behalf of ICE, giving immigration authorities what critics describe as side door access. Tan's federal complaint was filed in April in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California. The Institute for Justice is litigating the case and argues that the Fourth Amendment does not allow this type of surveillance. The organization says if San Jose wants to track people suspected of crimes, police should obtain a warrant, not monitor the entire driving population on the chance that the information might become useful later. and investigative reporter Christopher Ingram with the IJ warned that AI-powered license plate cameras are leading to the arrest of innocent people.
These cameras have trouble telling the difference between similar-looking characters like O and zero. They can also be inaccurate if there's dirt or another obstruction on the license plate. These inaccuracies hurt real people. IJ has found at least 24 such cases since 2018, with most happening in the past few years. Even worse, in almost two-thirds of the cases IJ reviewed, officers had their guns drawn on the motorist before realizing they had the wrong car.
The Institute for Justice has also documented more than two dozen cases in which law enforcement officers allegedly used license plate surveillance systems to stalk romantic interests. He also pointed to a case in Southern California.
Officers in San Diego were searching for a car connected to an attempted carjacking when their Flock system gave them a match. Not on the car's license plate, but on its appearance. The police found the vehicle and arrested the passengers, even though it was 5 miles away from the crime at the time it occurred. One of those innocent passengers spent nearly a month behind bars.
The Institute for Justice argues that these cases expose the constitutional dangers of warrantless ALPR surveillance. Among the largest companies in the industry is Flock Safety, founded in 2017. Its cameras are less expensive than traditional ALPR readers, allowing police departments to deploy them at a greater scale. Using artificial intelligence, the system turns a vehicle's visible characteristics, including its make, model, color, bumper stickers, and roof racks, into searchable data. But Flock is not the only company selling this technology, which is why the EFF, the ACLU, and the Institute for Justice are seeking broader restrictions on warrantless searches. Again, Bay Area Executive of CARE, Zahara Ballou.
There are other companies that offer them, and that is why in this lawsuit, our concern is less about a specific vendor and more about the actual data, how it is used, how it is accessed, and what controls exist. More and more federal agencies are intruding on local cities, counties, and states. So in addition to out-of-state agencies, one of our concerns, of course, is federal agencies accessing data, which we know has come up in a number of Bay Area cities, including, for example, Mountain View. Our hope is that this lawsuit will both set precedent to protect us in the future, but also send a clear signal to local police departments that they too are being watched and that we have concerns about their surveillance of our communities.
KPFA News will continue to follow these cases. Those interested in learning more about their rights can visit plateprivacy.com. For KPFA News, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
Following Wednesday's first court hearing, the EFF's privacy litigation director, Adam Schwartz, wrote to KPFA News saying, quote, "At the hearing yesterday, the court instructed the parties to file supplemental briefs addressing whether ALPRs invade the reasonable expectation of privacy of San Jose drivers to be free from automated government surveillance of their movements. We hope to persuade the court that ALPRs invade this privacy."
Not only are KPFK listeners smart, interesting, and forward-thinking, you're also very generous and deeply appreciated. Thank you so much for pledging your support to KPFK during our fund drive.